You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll hear about the three men who've been running the Department of Veterans Affairs from the President's Club Mar-a-Lago, despite having no official roles at the agency. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Governor Scott Walker and State Superintendent Tony Evers are hitting the ground running in their respective campaigns. Members of a ring of criminals targeting credit card information was arrested in Wisconsin. And a shortage of EpiPens has some parents in the state concerned about sending kids back to school. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Judith.
On Tuesday, we found out that Democrat Tony Evers will be the one to challenge Governor Scott Walker in the fall, and the two are not wasting any time at all getting their campaigns going. What have we seen so far?
Yeah, one thing about having such a late primary in mid-August is that the candidates want to waste no time getting into the general election. So, every week seems like impossibly packed lately, but this week really has seemed packed, as the primary seems like very long ago already. So Governor Walker already he kicked off his general election with a sort of a barnstorming tour around five cities around the state. So he was toured a factory in Green Bay. He was talking about some new proposed tax breaks in Eau Claire. And other places. And Tony Evers, the Democratic, newly minted Democratic nominee, likewise has made a series of campaign appearances with Mandela Barnes, who will be the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor. And the other thing that has that began right away are giant attack ad buys by both parties.
And are those ads, as you said, from the parties? Are we also seeing ones from outside groups already?
Yeah. So the big ad buys are from like the organized parties. The Democratic governors have a big ad buy that they're going to spend attacking Walker, and the state GOP itself put out some attack ads against Evers. This is going to be a competitive race for sure. We're going to see big outside spending, but these are the official official line.
This week, as you said, it's been a busy week. Governor Walker proposed expanding youth apprenticeships to middle school students, providing tax credits for recent college graduates, and some other initiatives. Is this part of the attempt to get out ahead of Evers, who's the head of public schools in the state, on educational issues, which some are saying might be the key to winning this election?
You see it. You see it. Even before the primary, as Evers says, he was he was leading in the polls and seen as the likely nominee, and it was understood that in political circles that when Walker refers to himself as the education governor and started to lay the groundwork, it was because that was likely to be seen as a vulnerability in his reelection campaign. And I think, it is a clear point of distinction between the two candidates. They've taken a different approach. They just have their support comes from different places in the education world. I think that's a big one. Roads are big too. there are other issues for sure. But I think, we're going to hear a lot about school funding and sort of what is needed in Wisconsin schools.
Well, and speaking of road funding, always an issue, always a case of people want the roads to be better. They're not necessarily crazy about paying extra for them. Governor Walker told supporters that Tony Evers would add up to a dollar gas tax per gallon. Evers responded that everything's on the table to fund roads. How might this play out for Wisconsinites, and what might they be willing to go along with to get better roads?
So, voters will have a chance to decide, I suppose. But this has been, Walker has been at odds with state Republicans for years about this, on this topic, how to fund roads. Maintenance, road building projects, and transportation. He's held the position that really any increase in fees or any increase in gas tax is totally verboten. And even if that means that some of the state's projects need to be stalled. And the state lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, tend to think, well, wait a minute, in my district, we need this project to go forward or whatever. So it's been a big issue already. Walker said this week that he has a transportation plan but is not ready yet to reveal it. But of course, I mean, we've had the last 8 years of policy. Evers has criticized Walker's policy, and this is the thing about not being the incumbent, is you can criticize the policy. He hasn't really laid out his plan. He does say everything is on the table, and one assumes that this certainly includes an increase to the gas tax, but it's a little undefined, and so it's a bit, it allows, I guess, Walker to say, oh, it's going to be a $50 increase, and Evers can say, no, it's nothing like that. But at some point, they're going to need to kind of put things on paper, I suppose.
We're talking with Rob Menser right now. He's a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau, and he joins us most weeks at this time to take a look back at the week's news. Rob, let's move on to an interesting story about some credit card fraud. Wisconsin law enforcement recently arrested several Romanian men who were part of a credit card skimming ring. And how did the operation actually work?
Yeah, this is I find this super interesting. This is my colleague Sophie Carson reported on this out of the Oshkosh Northwestern. This is an organized crime ring located in Romania. There are immigrants who come into the U.S. illegally. These young Romanian guys and travel across the country, according to these court records and in the charges that are. There's going to be a trial in I think it's Fond du Lac starting next week. And so they use these credit card skimming devices, which is it's like a device you actually put over the top of where you scan your credit card when you get gas or whatever. Mm-hmm. That captures people's credit card information when they swipe, and then they take that information, sort of like print these like phony, like a gift card type credit card, which they use to try to get cash.
Mm. And it sounds like gas stations were particularly targeted because fewer gas station, like at the pump, pay at the pump systems have the chip. It's the older style swiping.
Right, you swipe. Yeah, exactly. It's the swipe that does it. And they say the police say that you can notice these if you stop to look. But I mean, how many times have I gotten gas, right? And you just sort of swipe your card. It's not, I'm not doing an inspection,
right.
And so it makes you think but it's like a physical device that goes over the top of where you swipe the card, which they leave on and then have to go back and retrieve in order to get the information. So,
I think there's also a camera, right? So they're able to pick up the PIN numbers that go along with the swipe.
Right, yeah, they tell you to protect your PIN number or whatever, and it turns out there's actually a reason to do that. That's how they learn the PIN numbers was with a camera. So if you hold your hand over that can help protect you as well.
Well, kids are getting ready to go back to school. Parents are, getting them set up with supplies and what they need to go back. And pharmacies around Wisconsin and the rest of the country are seeing a shortage of a pretty important drug for a lot of families. That's EpiPens. First of all, what do people use EpiPens for, Rob?
So these are like the small shots that counteract severe allergies, like a kid who has a bad peanut allergy or seafood allergy or whatever. And so schools have to stock them, and obviously families rely on them because in the case of a severe allergy, it can be it is a life or death matter. But so it is back to school time, and so these are in demand. And this year there's more demand than there is supply. One reason, or I guess the reason for this, is it's a patented technology. The patent is held by this one pharmaceutical company, Mylan. And if they don't produce enough EpiPens, then there aren't enough to go around. And that's what, this is not the first time there's been a shortage, but there is a shortage being experienced in in Wisconsin and nationwide.
And also, there have been a lot of stories in the last year or so about the price of EpiPens being so high that it can be prohibitive for people who need it. But this is a whole different issue. This is, there just isn't enough of the medication.
It's kind of the same. I mean, in a way, it is the same issue, right? Like, the company can hike the price or they can reduce the supply, and it sort of amounts to the same thing. One piece of news, I mean, just yesterday, the Food and Drug Administration, for the first time, approved a generic version of the EpiPen. So that's not going to address anything like right away, but maybe in the future, hopefully the prices will come down. We can certainly hope that they will.
And Rob, briefly before we wrap up, you've been following a story that illustrates a lot about the troubles that dairy farmers are facing. A family in Door County is working to keep their farm afloat and got quite a bit of help. Can you tell us about them?
Right. Yeah, this was there was a profile of this 58-year-old dairy farmer in northeastern Wisconsin named Dale Seiler, who was in a terrible shape with the farm. He was deeply in debt, was dealing with some health problems, and looked like they might lose their farm. His wife, without his knowledge, made a GoFundMe site that raised $14,000 for the farm. And that's a good story. That was a touching story. This week, our reporter checked in on the family, and they are still working. But also, they made it clear they do not see themselves as out of the woods. That is, dairy farm is expensive to run, and they still face real issues. So it was it's nice that they were able to get the aid that they got, and we should just be real that their dairy farms are still under very serious pressures.
Well, and not enough for them and really only one family out of, probably hundreds who are facing that kind of pressure.
Absolutely, absolutely. Last year, 500 dairy farms in Wisconsin closed, were lost. So that in 2017, that is. So it's the situation is serious.
Well, Rob, as always, thanks for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Rob Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He was with us for our weekly roundup of news stories from around the state. It's been a tumultuous year and a half for leadership at the Department of Veterans Affairs, starting with the ouster of its former secretary, David Shulkin, to the failed nomination attempt of Ronnie Jackson, President Trump's pick to head the agency. He was accused of drinking on the job and creating a hostile work environment. And now more questions are being raised about who's actually in charge of the agency, after a report from ProPublica exposed a group of three men outside the government who've been directing the VA from the president's private club, Mar-a-Lago. Isaac Arensdorf broke the story for ProPublica. He covers politics, influence, and the Trump administration. Isaac, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start at the beginning. How did you first hear about these three men essentially running the VA from Mar-a-Lago?
Well, there were some rumors around Washington in the veterans policy community that there were these secret meetings happening in Mar-a-Lago, but no one really knew what they were or who was there. The one person who was sort of known was Ike Perlmutter, the chairman of Marvel Entertainment, who is a friend of President Trump's and had been advising him informally on veterans issues. And then at some point I figured out there was a doctor who was there, but didn't have a name. I eventually got a name, and then I heard there was a lawyer, and eventually got a name, and was kind of slowly just piecing together the puzzle of what became a really sweeping, vast influence of these three guys from Mar-a-Lago that was happening completely unknown except to a few senior VA leaders who were interacting with them.
And so it's not unusual for presidents to have, kind of an informal kitchen cabinet of people who he trusts to, bounce ideas off of, things like that. What is different about this group of three men and how they are connected to the Veterans Affairs Administration?
Right. So presidents will consult with people outside government all the time. That's not unusual. What's different about this is how they're like assigned specifically to an agency, and that it's not just the president talking to them, but it's actually the VA officials flying down to Mar-a-Lago at taxpayer expense to meet with them and ask them to review policy and personnel decisions before they take effect. So that is really, there's not really a precedent for that in modern history.
So you said that one is the head of Marvel Entertainment, one is a doctor, one is a lawyer. What are their qualifications, or why would they be this involved in the Veterans Administration?
That is the precise question that all these officials at the VA have been asking themselves for the past year and a half, because it really doesn't make any sense to them why an entertainment executive and a doctor who serves very wealthy people in Palm Beach and a lawyer who doesn't have any experience with veterans or healthcare, none of them has ever served in the U.S. government or U.S. military. Why these guys, why they're making it their business, helping to decide what direction the Trump administration takes the VA in. But the answer is that they have the attention of the president. And in this case, that seems to be what counts.
And we talked about former Secretary David Shulkin. He was fired. He, as I read in your piece, he was actually basically put in place by this group.
So his name initially surfaced in a meeting that they organized at Mar-a-Lago, and they recommended him to President Trump, and that is a big part of how he ended up getting the job in the first place. And then there was a meeting after he was nominated, but before he was confirmed, where he went to Mar-a-Lago to meet them, and they kind of clearly established the ground rules, and this was one of the emails that I obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, where they made clear, you know, like, you're going to have to, well, we don't have to meet every month, but we're going to meet regularly, and we're going to be talking regularly, and we're going to be kind of like a board of directors, and we're going to be, like, overseeing you as, like, a CEO.
And so how involved have they been? And I was going to say, were they, but nothing has changed so far, as far as I'm aware. How involved have they been in the day-to-day workings of the Veterans Administration?
Extensively. I mean, there really isn't a major issue that's risen to the senior leadership that they haven't had a thing to say about. They've been in touch with VA officials as often as every day, and about a whole range of policy issues. Probably the biggest one was a $10 billion contract to upgrade the agency's electronic health records. And the other thing that's happened that's very important is over the past year and a half, what you've seen is the people who got along with them got promoted, and the people who didn't get along with them were sidelined or pushed out.
We're talking with Isaac Arnsdorf right now. He covers politics, influence, and the Trump administration at ProPublica. We're talking about his extensive research and writing about a trio of men who belong to the Mar-a-Lago Club in Florida, which is owned by President Trump, who are basically running the Veterans Administration from behind the scenes. And Isaac, you know, is this legal? What are they doing that is either on the side of legality or getting into some pretty murky areas?
So, I mean, there's obviously no law against people expressing their views to government officials and government officials listening to outside stakeholders. But there is a law from the 1970s. It's a Watergate era sunshine law that says, if federal agencies are going to be consulting outside experts, they need to do it in an organized and transparent way. So they need to notify the public that they're doing this. They need to have public participation, and they need to have a range of perspectives on these committees. And so this week what happened is a veterans group sued the VA, claiming that this arrangement with these three guys at Mar-a-Lago bypasses that law, and you're not allowed to do that. So they're asking a judge to say that these guys aren't allowed to do what they're doing until they follow all the rules that that law says they have to follow, meaning disclose everything that they're doing and allow public participation.
There were questions about whether some of their business interests might be getting a boost, getting advanced by some of the actions. Are there possible other lawsuits that could eventually be brought against them?
So that's a tricky question. They're obviously not government officials who are subject to the ethics rules that government officials have to follow. Some lawyers, there is a Department of Justice opinion that when people exercise authority like government officials, they sometimes do have to abide by that. Now, these guys at Mar-a-Lago say that's not what's happening here, but just setting that aside, that would be something that would be enforceable by the Justice Department. So that would be the Trump administration enforcing it against the Trump administration. So that's sort of different from the situation I just described with the veterans group bringing a civil action from outside the government. But yeah, I mean, absolutely, you know, part of what why people are concerned about this arrangement is because when you don't have people following those ethics rules like government officials, it creates opportunities for people to support their own personal interests or pet causes. And you did see that that Secretary Shulkin at the New York Stock Exchange last November rang the closing bell with Captain America from Marvel and the parent company Disney. And that's kind of a weird thing for a government official to do. And they consulted the ethics officials within the agency. They were aware that this was questionable, and they wanted to make sure that it was kosher.
And very briefly, Isaac, as we wrap up, have you gotten any response after your story was published from those three men who are so involved in the VA?
Through a spokesperson, they sent me another statement yesterday, which basically reiterated what they said originally, which is that they did not exercise direct authority, and they were just volunteers who were providing advice to try to help the agency. Now, obviously, the question of whether that advice was optional or not in the eye of the people who were receiving it is not everyone agrees about that.
Well, Isaac, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Isaac Arensdorf, politics reporter at ProPublica. He was with us to talk about his story about a group of three men outside of the government who are influencing the direction of the VA. President Trump's rise has led to a lot of soul searching in the Republican Party. Some have embraced his shift away from things like free trade and a tough stance on Russia. Others in the party have been skeptical or rejected his brand of Republicanism outright. But while the country's been focused on what party loyalists and the Republican base will do with Trumpism, much less attention has been given to young conservatives and how they feel about the party's shift. Eliza Gray is a freelance writer who's written for publications like Time and The New Republic. She took a closer look at the question in a recent piece for The Washington Post magazine. Eliza, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
This was quite an ambitious project. You talked to 52 young, about college-age conservatives from all across the spectrum of conservatism. What was your goal in taking on this project?
My goal was to find out what young conservatives roughly under the age of 24 were thinking about the president and the direction that the Republican Party has been taking over the last, 2 years or so. And I really wanted to speak, for better or worse, to people who were likely to become leaders in the party at some point. So I wasn't just targeting any old voter. I was looking for people who were either working in Republican politics post-college or were involved in leadership positions in Republican or conservative groups on campus.
And you wanted to make sure that you were speaking with people who were representative of the different factions or kind of different shades of the Republican Party. How did you go about doing that?
Yeah, so I started with the College Republicans, which is an old campus group that listeners might be familiar with. And that was sort of to get a sense of the party line. And I spoke to some of them first. And then as I spoke to them, I kind of got a sense of the different groups available on campuses. I spoke to members of the Young Americans for Freedom, Young Americans for Liberty, which is a libertarian group that started after Ron Paul's presidential campaign. And I also reached out to a Christian Young Leaders Network to sort of reach evangelical, Christian, and Catholic conservatives. And I also reached out to young women's groups to talk to those folks and people who were editors of conservative publications. So, yeah, I was really trying to get at the whole spectrum. I also reached out specifically to people who I knew had been active in supporting Donald Trump so that I would get their perspective as well.
So it sounds like there's quite a bit of variety in maybe the focus of the different groups that you reached out to, the people involved in them. But it also seemed from reading your article that there were some commonalities that they almost all seem to have. What were some of the things that you heard over and over that they're really on the same page about?
Yeah, I mean, I think, on balance, by and large, I think I found that most of the young people I talked to were not super excited about President Donald Trump. I would say that there were also not a ton of people that were quote unquote never Trumpers. It almost seemed like most people felt like they wanted to be able to talk about some of the things that the president has done from a policy perspective that they liked, and sort of distance that from kind of their feelings personally about the president. Another really striking commonality was this overwhelming adulation for Ben Shapiro, who is a radio personality on the right, who's also, you know, young in his 30s. More than a third of the people I talked to mentioned him just off the cuff. And, you know, what Ben Shapiro has in common with a lot of them is that he isn't sort of a supporter of the president's, you know, at any cost, unlike sort of people like Sean Hannity and other folks on Fox News. You know, Ben Shapiro takes a pretty critical eye towards the president. And what a lot of the young people said that they liked about him was this sense that he liked to talk about principle and the ideas behind what, you know, why he takes certain conservative positions, rather than taking sort of a cult of personality approach, which I think has become sort of part of the sort of Trumpist politics that we've seen, where some Trumpians kind of support the president almost no matter what.
It is interesting because you say in your piece that kind of going along with what you just said about Ben Shapiro and that young conservatives liking him because he will say what he agrees with and he will also say what he does not agree with. They also said that the person in the Trump administration they admired most was Nikki Haley, and it was for that same reason that she would actually stand up to President Trump.
Yeah, they really, I heard again and again praise for Nikki Haley, feeling like she's an independent spirit who is willing to challenge the president. I think what young people don't want to see is just a blind following of a person without any backing for or any sort of explanation for why you believe what you believe. I think that they really are reaching out for kind of a set of principles to chart the party forward. And I think that they're not really seeing that from the president.
We're talking with Eliza Gray right now. She's a freelance writer, and her recent piece for the Washington Post magazine is titled The Next Generation of Republicans. And Eliza, I thought it was interesting what you just said a moment ago. I want to go back to it, that a lot of these young conservatives that you spoke with said that, you know, they like people like Ben Shapiro who will who won't just, you know, go with the president no matter what. They, you know, they're critical of outlets like Fox News and personalities like Sean Hannity, who no matter what the president says will defend it. There's also seems to be a reluctance on the part of Republican Party leadership to come out against the president on specific issues and say, wait a minute, you know, this is not what we have stood for or want to stand for. What do you think that means for both kind of the mainstream conservative media outlets and also the aging Republican leadership if these young people are kind of not buying what they're selling?
I think it's a real problem for them. I think that certainly, you know, I think Fox News does not appeal to young people. You know, I did speak to 52 of them, and doesn't seem like a single one of them got their news from Fox. So I don't think that is a place that really holds a lot of sway with young people. And I think, you know, in terms of the Republican Party just sort of towing the line with the president, I don't think that that does inspire young people. That isn't to say that the young people hate everything that Donald Trump does. As I wrote in my piece, you know, many young conservatives were excited about Neil Gorsuch. It was before Kavanaugh's nomination, so we were talking just about that. And they were also excited, a lot of them, about tax reform. And they didn't want to have to say that they weren't excited about those things. I mean, those are sort of conservative policy ideas. But they also wanted a party that was going to actually articulate for them sort of ideas about policies and how we could move forward, you know, on things like maybe criminal justice reform or healthcare or immigration. I think they really want to talk about policy and ideas. And I think, and what the, why people believe what they believe. I don't think that they want, you know, just to follow this man in his 70s at any cost. So I do think it's a real risk. I did put in my piece that a number of young people have left the Republican Party. Pew showed some data that before the election, to after Donald Trump was elected, 25% of people from age 18 to 29 had become Democrats. And I think that the Republican Party is at risk of losing even more of those people if they can't become more of a party of ideas and solutions.
We've seen a lot of talk and evidence of a split in the Democratic Party between the longtime leadership and people who are coming up through the ranks and saying, hey, it's time for more diversity. It's time for more women. It's time for more young voices in leadership, and some resistance, I think it's fair to say, from the leadership that is in place. Are you seeing maybe on the horizon a similar split or conflict within the Republican Party?
That's interesting. I don't think that young conservatives are as interested in, I guess, identity politics as Democrats are. So I don't think it's as important to young conservatives that people of certain genders or races or ages are running. I think that actually what's more troubling to them is the lack of ideas and principles. What they like about Ben Shapiro is that usually when he lays out an argument for why he believes something, he doesn't just say, this is what I think, screw you if you don't agree. He actually says, okay, this is what I think and why. So yeah, I think, you know, certainly, if for sort of older party leaders, I mean, I didn't hear much excitement about Mitch McConnell among young people. And so I think, you know, certainly leaders who aren't coming up with sort of dynamic ideas and kind of going out there with sort of interesting backbone, I think that they could expect to see some challenges from young conservative voters in the future.
One of the things that I found interesting in your reporting was that many of the young conservatives that you spoke with really wanted to see a bipartisan approach to governing. What were some of the examples or some of the ways that they hoped that that would be maybe possible in the future?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I thought was really interesting was just how much young people are excited about criminal justice reform, which is to say that, you know, they're interested in seeing shifts maybe to mandatory minimum sentencing laws that put people in jail, in prison, rather, for low-level drug offenses. I think, though they might differ on whether marijuana should be legal or not legal, or we should just lower, you know, decriminalize it, I think that varied. But I think that there was a real genuine desire among a lot of people to see change in that regard, and a real rejection of the sort of tough-on-crime policies that Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, has put forward. I think a lot of young people are really disappointed to see that. And I think that's an area where they're really excited to work with their Democratic peers on if, you know, when they get a chance to take control when they get older.
We're talking with Eliza Gray about the next generation of Republicans and their feelings about the change in the party under President Trump. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a young conservative? What do you think about the way President Trump is changing the Republican Party? What parts of President Trump's agenda do you embrace? And which parts are you not that excited about? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment here on Central Time. We're continuing our conversation with Eliza Gray about her recent piece looking at what young conservatives think of President Trump and the Republican Party. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you the parent of a young person with conservative values? What differences do you see in this generation's conservatism versus that of your generation or maybe of your parents? Are you excited about the way Republicans in their early 20s may change the party? Or do you think they're taking the party down the wrong path? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Eliza, one student that you spoke with was from UW-Madison here in Wisconsin. His name is Jake Lubinow. He's the former chair of the College Republicans at the school. Tell us about Jake and how his thinking has evolved.
Yeah, so Jake was a great person to talk to, and his job as the chairman of the College Republicans is a big job. Wisconsin is a very active political state, and it's an active political chapter. Jake, you know, I think was really wary of President Trump from the beginning, and that hadn't changed after the election. I think one thing he saw that troubled him was sort of a feeling among young Republicans that they didn't want to be associated with the party. So he mentioned, helping his colleagues at Young Republicans, College Republicans, applying for jobs, and they didn't want to list College Republicans on their resume because they thought that it would be toxic to employers. So I think that was something that sort of surprised him a bit and seemed pronounced after the president's election. He isn't somebody who wants to leave the party. And so I think he was a person who's really trying to go along, to get along and bring together Trumpian Republicans who tend to be more protectionist with trade policy versus somebody like him who's more, you know, for free trade. But I think he found that, you know, bringing up policy at meetings was really tough, and that, you know, he was trying to veer away from areas where there were conflicts. So it sort of felt like he was in a challenging position of trying to sort of hold it all together after the election.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Mark in Milwaukee is up first. Hi, Mark.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
How's it doing today?
Good. Go ahead.
I just want to say that I'm an avid Ben Shapiro listener. I love his opinions and the fact that he's willing to address both sides of an argument. And I'm also a Trump voter for policy, not necessarily his antics, which I feel like most Republicans can agree to. It's just one of those things where I feel, as a young Republican, I'm 28 years old, that we're just trying to see some sort of economic improvement and something different. And whether or not Donald Trump was the number one draft choice, I don't know about that. But he did check a lot of the boxes for some of his policies. And I feel that's where a lot of the Republican, younger Republicans are going for, is somebody who is able to get our policies addressed. And hopefully we can find somebody that can do it in a less brash manner.
And Mark, let me ask you, in 2016, who were you hoping would be the Republican nominee?
Whew, that was a tough year. I was with Dr. Ben Carson for a little while. He was doing really good. And then some of his policies I didn't necessarily agree with as far as education, that's beside the point. I eventually got on the Trump train because he was our choice, and that is better than the Democratic nomination that was available.
All right. Thanks for that call, Mark. And Eliza, that's something that came up in your interviews with the Young Conservatives was even when they agreed with some of the policy initiatives and successes of President Trump, they really wished, as Mark called them, antics, that some of the things like tweeting and things like that, that maybe those could be left behind.
Absolutely. And I think Mark also hinted at a point that a lot of people made, which was the sense that this brashness or this sense of maybe unkindness or lack of tolerance that the president sometimes positions in his rhetoric, that I think, you know, a lot of young people, as Mark said, want to see policies that they think will be good for the economy or other areas that they think is important, but they don't really want to see that kind of unkind, divisive rhetoric that they sometimes see from the president.
Let's go now to Steve in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm somewhat of a new Republican. I'm more libertarian by nature. And I always felt the number one threat that we had as a country was our debt load and how that would just swamp us. But over the past few years, my thinking has changed. And I do agree with Trump that our number one threat we have is fake news and them being the enemy of the people. And I'm wondering what young people feel about that, because there's a lot of Republicans for years have said the same thing, but kind of jokingly. But Trump is actually out there and saying the truth. Wondering what young people feel about that, because I love it.
Thanks for that call, Steve. And Eliza, you know, what were you hearing about where young people are feeling like they're getting the real deal, the real talk from?
So I will say make 2 points. The first is that I do think young people share older generations' feeling that the media is biased and does not necessarily fairly represent the news. So I do think that there's definitely a commonality there. For what it's worth, I will say that more than 90% of the young conservatives I talked to, despite the fact that I was writing for a mainstream media outlet, were incredibly open and kind with me. And I actually had a lot of really positive conversations, and that, I just want to highlight that because I think that's important. You know, it's if you are mistrustful of the media, I still think it's good to sort of engage. And I think as a result of our engagement, we were able to really put out a story that I think was fair and really represented how a lot of them felt.
And as we wrap up, Eliza, you know, you talk to all these young people. Do you see there being inevitable change for the Republican Party as these young conservatives, you know, kind of come into their own?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I mean, politics aside, I came away from the conversations feeling hopeful about the future. I felt that a lot of these young people, as I said, were really eager to engage with me. They were really eager to engage on ideas. I think they really wanted to move away from some of the kind of provocation and divisive rhetoric and come together. Whether or not they can do that is maybe another question, but I came away feeling good about the group of people who might want to take over in the future. So I felt hope.
Eliza, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Eliza Gray. She joined us to talk about her piece for the Washington Post magazine titled The Next Generation of Republicans. Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll talk about the history of drunkenness and how it's influenced our culture. Spoiler alert, we've been hitting the bottle for thousands of years. And we'll talk with a Sun Prairie couple who is traveling across the U.S. And as they go, they're hosting a podcast called The Cross Country Coffee Roadshow. That's coming up Monday right here on Central Time.